You're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Patrick Hester and Tracy Townsend.
Tracy.
Yes.
I don't get to do this very often, so I like to do this at the end of the year. It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas.
It is. I mean, you know what? It used to, because again, Chicagoland area, we had three solid weeks of snow on the ground, cold temperatures after like a big snowfall in the week following Thanksgiving. And it authentically looked, it was like a 1990s Christmas of my childhood, right? And then it was 50 degrees and rainy on Thursday. So It's basically all gone except for like the really big hillocks that the plow has made at various points.
Colorado has no snow. No, snow. We're just dry. Just dry. No snow, no nothing. No moisture.
It's wild.
Yeah. We have wildfire warnings going off every day. It's insane. Welcome to Climate Change 101.
I guess, man. I guess. It's not fun. Dislike.
But you know what is fun? Cars.
Yes.
You know what is fun? I'm gonna do a Tracy. You know what's fun?
What's
short
fun?
Short story collections.
That's true. Short story collections are fun. And actually, this is an extremely timely time, she said, being very redundant, to be talking about short story collections because we, at the school where I teach, cue the music, I guess, we just finished the semester and I'm coming into the spring with speculative fiction studies, which I'll be teaching four sections of. God help me and save me. So it's going to be my entire workload in the spring of speculative fiction studies. And I drive the class primarily through short stories. So I do love me having some new authors or new to me authors in any case on the radar for that. Which means that it's a really timely moment to have Emily Mitchell on. So Emily, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
So, in fact, your background in short stories is deep enough that as we were talking in the Greek room, at the green room, I actually...
The Greek room.
Well, I mean, breaking plates in it, the breaking plates room. As we were talking in the green room, I actually got turned around about which collection we're talking about because this is not your first foray into a short story collection. So bravo and congratulations there. Talk to us, though, about the Church of Divine Electricity. How does this thing come together for you?
Yeah, well, so, so as you're saying, the Church of Divine Electricity, which is my new collection just out this fall, is my second book of short stories. I think the best way to describe it is, you know, around about 2016, for a variety of reasons, I found myself writing all these strange and speculative short stories. Speculative fiction isn't the only thing I write. You know, I've also written realistic fiction and I have a novel that's historical fiction. So I'm all over the map in terms of genre. For a while I thought maybe I could just settle down in one genre, but that doesn't appear to be happening. So I'm just going to go with it. The Church of Divine Electricity was... really kind of came almost as a surprise to me. It was just where I found my imagination going. And it started with one of the stories in the collection is called In Which I Tried to Save the World from Total Destruction Through the Power of Art. And it's the story of somebody who meets an alien ambassador who's come to Earth to try to decide what to do with the human race. His people would quite like the planet for themselves. The ambassador is looking to see if there's a good reason to let human beings stick around. That story came out, I wrote it by hand in a notebook, after a period of being a bit stuck with my work. After that, all of the things that I was writing seemed to fit into this mode of, sort of science fiction, but mostly in the near future, some stuff that verged more into magical realism, a couple of stories that work with the conventions of horror. After a while, I found that I had a book if you write short fiction, then you know that the question of kind of when do I have a whole book is always an interesting one. You have these individual stories. Do they make something, that is a complete thing of its own? And so I worked with them for a while. I moved them around. I tried different orders. I put things in, I took things out. And eventually I had what felt to me like a collection to try to begin to, you know, to look for a publisher for. But honestly, you know, I think that I was turning to speculative fiction because the world seemed so completely strange. You know, changing so quickly, going to places that I had never anticipated. And really, this was the genre that felt like it was able to reflect some of that actually back to me, to capture the way that it felt to be living through the last, let's say, 10 years.
Yeah. There's something about a genre whose broad sets of conventions, which I use that term advisedly. I don't know that there actually is an agreed upon set of conventions for speculative fiction exactly, but if we pretended they were, there's something about a genre whose broad conventions gives you the ability to talk about the feeling of being like unmoored from what you thought was real in your own world. That can be a real relief. Like even when it manifests in really dark ways, like these stories give us the toolbox for saying something about really complicated feelings about our own world. I wouldn't, in that carrying those feelings around myself, I don't know that I would worry too much about landing in another genre and continuing to cruise around. I think I would sit there as long as I needed to work stuff out.
Yeah, well, that's definitely what I did, you know, and what I found is that subsequently I've continued to work on more speculative fiction, after this book. I have always loved science fiction and read it ever since I was a kid and kind of never really turned away from it. But definitely, you know, I couldn't agree more with what you're saying about the way that it allows you, to look at things in a way that realistic fiction, you know, sometimes doesn't quite. That I think can open up imaginative possibilities, even if the story that you're telling is grim, right? Even if it's looking at things that are difficult to face. You had started talking about climate change. And I think, you know, we kind of need speculative fiction in order to think about that clearly. Think about it and also feel about it, right? It's something that kind of deeply troubling, that we're really looking for ways to, you know, to kind of process our emotions about it, and those two things seem very connected to me, right? Like they're not separate processes.
I've always thought that speculative fiction allows you to talk about things that make people uncomfortable in new and different ways. So if you have a story set in the real world where you're trying to talk about something uncomfortable, people will just, they won't focus on it, right? They will, it makes them uncomfortable. And so that's all they focus on is the how they're feeling. Like I'm uncomfortable about this, not necessarily the underlying thing that you're trying to get across to them. Right. And so when you do something with speculative fiction, it allows them to escape a little bit. And then you have this other message that's kind of in there, and I think it just works better. That's why I've always loved Star Trek, right? They're always able to sneak those little moral things in there to make you go, oh, yeah, okay, yeah. Shit, I didn't think about that. Okay.
I think that's right. I think that it works the way dreams work. In the sense of, you know, it allows you to combine things that aren't combined in the real world. And that when you do that, it allows people to see connections between things that aren't immediately obvious, but also that are there, you know, under the surface. And for me, like, that's kind of, you know, like one of speculative fiction's great powers is it brings together things that seem separate in the real waking world. But then actually, if you look at them, they're connected, in ways that you maybe didn't anticipate or weren't aware of. And even as a writer, that you maybe weren't aware of yourself as you were working. But then suddenly, these two things you know, that go together. You know, so thinking about, you know, there's a story in this collection, you know, where, you know, there's a character who's invited to go on a reality TV show. And he's so focused on coming up with ideas for the show that he stops noticing the disintegration of the things that are around him. And, you know, and we don't, I think about, you know, climate change or social collapse as being, you know, connected to reality TV. But to me, in a way, they seemed, after I wrote that story, as though, like, yeah, you know, like sometimes our focus gets very, very narrow on something quite personal, and we maybe miss some of these other bigger things that are going on around us.
Mm-hmm. I will definitely go on the bandwagon of reality TV is causing social collapse and climate change and destroying our society. I can't stand reality TV.
Yeah. I feel like I'm returning to an old hobby horse here for me, but I've talked before in Picks of the Week and other sorts of contexts about how in the last year or so, my daughter and I have kind of fallen in love with the Great British Baking Show. And you sometimes see people sort of memeing the distinction between a American reality television competition show versus like this particular British competition show. And one of the formats that I've seen is someone going like, you know, American baking show, British baking show, you know, colon, be like, we're all going to bake together in this white tent and like be a little bit sad if the pudding turns out stodgy, but it's hugs at the end for all and a cup of tea. And then the next one is like Americans, like we've given you this pantry, which is wrapped in barbed wire and you have to unwrap. And then you have to use this coonskin as the container for all of the food that you're going to make while someone's shooting at you.
Yeah.
And the hyperbole there is really about the kind of, to the point that you're making about reality television kind of sidelong, and how it kind of disconnects us from the reality of actual things disintegrating around us. Like we're so connected to the idea of what is this competition or what is this drama that I can invest myself in, or in this case that this guy can craft, you know, as someone who's like part of developing the reality TV, that you're not paying attention to like actual conflicts that have stakes around you and the role that you could potentially play in understanding them or mitigating them or anything. You're like, no, I have to figure out who gets voted off the island. I have to figure out, you know, who gets chopped or so on. It becomes a kind of like crutch for us. Yeah. That we have to displace the part of our brains that kind of want conflict as a form of amusement, but don't want conflict as a stage towards the resolution of anything.
Here's the thing though. I do draw a distinction between cooking shows and reality television. When I think of reality television, yeah, I'm thinking of the Kardashians, right?
Oh,
and okay. I'm thinking of, yes, The Amazing Race and Survivor and those kinds of, like, I hate those things. I think they're just garbage. But you get like when I did have cable, I loved Food Network. I loved watching people cook and do stuff. Like I just thought that was really good. The issue that I always had with Food Network that I could still have, like if I watched it today, I could still have, is they're like, it's really easy to make this and I'm going to show you how. Number one, you're lying. It's not going to be easy to make this.
You just said I need to make a water bath. That's strike one.
It's not going to work. Okay. And number two, they're like, I got this ingredient from this corner, like, because it was Food Network. They were all in New York and they were all like, we went downstairs to the corner market or whatever, and we got these imported raspberries that came from a tree that only grows in one part of the world and for 6 weeks. And so we got these and, you know, you can use whatever. Kroger doesn't have that shit. Kroger doesn't have it. Okay. Mm-hmm. You go into Kroger and it's like, we have apples, oranges, and mystery fruit in the bin over here. And maybe some bananas. Like, they're not going to have this special ingredient that you – like it just doesn't happen. So that's where I always felt like that's where the unrealistic part of Food Network came from. Fair. It's like, yeah, Giada De Laurentiis is going to make this great thing and Bobby Flay is going to make this great thing. I can't get those ingredients. Those ingredients don't exist here. I shop at Kroger. Kroger doesn't have them.
I'm gonna do a Tracy here, but those ingredients do exist in speculative fiction. but no, like I'm actually kind of being sincere here, and I think I am interested in Emily's take on this. Like, I've been thinking about it as you've been talking, Patrick. Speculative fiction is cooking, or cooking is speculative fiction. Invert them as you please, because ultimately it is largely the same kitchen of ingredients, right? The same toolbox that realistic fiction writers use to craft their stories is largely the same toolbox that creators of speculative fiction are using. They've got dialogue, they've got setting, they've got characterization, they have stakes and so on. They may interpret those things differently, develop those things differently, focus on them differently, but it is ultimately like, behold the pantry of ingredients. If you combine these two things together, you have a person. If you combine these two things together, you have an alien or a robot or whatever else. But that ultimately we're trying to kind of draw from that in order to create something novel that will kind of, my metaphor is getting really strained here, like nourish us in a different way. Oh, Emily, save me from my nonsense metaphors.
Well, what I can say is I would totally be into watching Barbed Wire Pantry Shootout that you just described.
I mean, it does sound
kind
of metal.
I would completely go for that show. And I did, you know, maybe I can square the circle this way. Like, I had a phase of watching Gordon Ramsay's Kitchen Nightmares.
Yeah.
Obsessively, and the whole show, you know, just, you know, like that was my reality TV, like, addiction for a while. You know, and I can't explain it. But there was something about, about that combination of, like, you know, like his personality and these struggling restaurants and the restaurateurs who were trying to make a go of it, that, like, absolutely, like, I couldn't stop watching it. But I do think, you know, like that, you know, that idea of you're drawing from the same, you know, kind of set of ingredients. Yeah, like that, like definitely. You know, there you can have stories about aliens that do the same thing that stories about aliens, you know, have always done. And to a certain extent, if you're talking about, you know, say an alien visitor to Earth, you're thinking about difference. You're thinking about outsiderhood. You're thinking about, you know, the way in which, you know, maybe fiction as a whole tries to step back and give us a view of human beings from a distance that lets us see things we couldn't see any other way. But at the same time, you know, you have stories that are very conventional about aliens and we feel like we've seen this before. And then, you know, someone is always doing something new and interesting, you know, with those possibilities.
I'm not ready to give up on Food Network yet. So I will say this. I will say this. The show that I wanted to see, I liked Chopped.
Okay.
But I liked Chopped the most when they used ingredients that were suggested by viewers.
Mm. Okay.
It's like leftover pizza. The leftover 6-inch sandwich from Subway that's in my fridge. Like, I liked when they had to use those things and those chefs were pissed. Because again, they want to use the fancy ingredients and stuff. The show that I wanted to see that Food Network would never make is Bobby Flay or Giada or Alton or somebody has to come to your house and cook with your pans on your stove with the ingredients in your pantry and your fridge.
Oh, gosh. I think it was on Netflix because I watched the hell out of it for a little while with Deirdre. There was a cooking show on Netflix, and I think it only went for maybe one or two seasons. That is, I think it's called Greatest Leftovers Ever or something like that, where it's just literally what they refer to as home cooks, you know, just people who are, you know, they make tape and an application or whatever and to get on the show, who are pretty talented and creative, and they don't like wasting stuff. Like, that's their whole thing. Like, I like to make sure everything that in my fridge ends up going onto a plate and getting eaten and not ending up in the bin. And so they would have these people come on and they would be assigned different leftovers around a theme. Be like, here's part of a leftover Chinese takeaway. Like, here's part of a leftover burger and fries. Like, here's a leftover corn dog. And
I'm not just talking about leftovers. I just mean, like, whatever I have in my pantry is what you have to use. Whatever I have in my pantry.
No.
And you have to use my skillet that is nonstick, but the nonstick is coming off. And the burners on my stove, only two of them work.
Bro, get rid of that cancer skillet. What you doing?
No, but I'm saying that's what I want them to use, like that. That, but to tie it back to Emily for a second.
Yes, please.
and cooking. There is a trend now at a lot of literary science fiction conventions of having the Chopped-esque flash fiction contest.
Interesting.
I've seen it, like we do it every year at Mile High Con. Mm-hmm. I've seen it at other cons where it's basically authors sign up to be part of this and they're given prompts from the crowd or from like somehow their prompts are given. Everybody has to write a story with those ingredients and then they have to read that story and it's like a flash fiction thing and you only get like 1,000 words or whatever. And then you kind of eliminate over time. It's like, yep, this one is the one we didn't like. Let's, you know, thank that person for coming. And we're going to move on to this one. And like, I've seen that at conventions now, which I think is an interesting little speed writing thing that's happening.
And that sounds amazing. I think personally, like I would be absolutely terrified to try to write something that fast. Like, I don't know how you'll write. Like for me, it's like, you know, like the story takes, you know, like once I have the idea that, you know, then like a couple years later, I have the story.
Yeah.
But like, I love the idea of people, you know, sort of remixing these different, you know, they have a set of parameters. I mean, it sounds like improv. Like it sounds like
it
improv
is.
Theater.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a big time improv. And the people who are part of it have a blast with it. So it's definitely a thing that happens. I know usually at Pikes Peak Writers and probably Rocky Mountain Fiction Writers as well, which are writing conferences, they tend to have, you know, ongoing flash fiction contests throughout the weekend. And you'll get a prompt like and it's almost like a if I remember correctly, it was like a treasure hunt. Like you had to go and find the person who has the prompts and get as many of the prompts as you can from people. And then you put them together to write a little story and then you submit it. And yeah, that's kind of fun, too.
Yeah. Amazing.
I used to do this writing activity with my creative writing workshop students, but I haven't done it since the pandemic because it just seemed like it was not a great time to be sending kids to do this particular task. But the idea behind it was they had like a list that was a little bit like a list for a scavenger hunt, where they had to find a certain number of people who they knew from the school where I teach, which is a boarding school, and then a certain number of people who are not connected to the boarding school. I think it was like 5 and 5. And their job was to go around, and they had like a week to do it. They had to go around and approach people and say, I am in a creative writing class and I am a spontaneous writing minstrel. And I would like to write you a poem right now on the spot on any topic you like. Please give me a topic. And they would have like a little notebook or whatever. And they would write the thing on demand and then turn it over to the person and then walk away. But before they did, of course, with the scavenger hunt form, they would have to have the person write down like, I am this person who asked this person to do this thing. And here's the topic I gave them. And it was meant to teach 3 things. And they would do this. Right. And then they would like do a postmortem with me as a discussion in the class. And like, how did that go? What did you think of it? And of course, there were some kids who were like, I fucking hated it. Don't ever make me do that again. That was the worst. And then other kids who were like, I warmed to it over time or whatever. But it was meant to teach 3 things. One, that kind of like improv spontaneousness that you're talking about there, Patrick, similar to the Chopped but for flash fiction thing. 2, just I talk to my students a lot about mastering the fear of sucking. The major thing that keeps most people from writing is not literally I have no ideas or literally I forgot all the words and I am blocked and I have no words in my head. It's just like you could start writing a thing, but you're afraid the idea sucks and you're afraid it's stupid. And so you don't. You start doing it and you start worrying partway through that it's stupid. And so you abandon it. But it's that fear of sucking that kind of paralyzes, right? That keeps you from moving forward. Because generally speaking, you have to write something that's pretty shit to get to something that's better. Like it has to start out in its crap form before it can like Pokemon transformation to something better than that. So part of it's the mastering the fear of sucking. But the final thing it was meant to teach was letting go. Like you don't get to keep this. You write it down and you hand it to the person and you walk away. So there's a chance that you wrote something where you're like, hot damn, I think I liked writing that. And I don't think it was stupid. And I kind of, but no, you got to give it to them. It belongs to the reader now. Like teaching them the idea that like when you make a thing, you don't actually own it anymore. In a sure. sense, it sort of goes out into the universe and it's going to become whatever it's going to become for this person. Maybe they'll love it and they'll keep it tucked in their wallet forever. Maybe they will read it and snort and toss it in a recycle bin. You have no idea. And you just never will. And it was most gratifying for me when I saw students arrive at the understanding that those were the three goals without me having to tell them that that's what they were going for. But in a lot of ways, the short story is the spontaneous writing minstrelsy act of fiction, right? It is like the sort of like, hello, I have just showed up and I have this thing for you. Join me, won't you? And we kind of cross our fingers that the reader is up for that little journey.
Yeah. I mean, I think your assignment sounds like it gave your students the entire process of becoming a writer in super high speed. You know, the whole thing of like, okay, I have an idea. I have to like deal with whatever anxieties I have about it, you know, in order to complete it. Zadie Smith says writing a novel is like playing a confidence trick on yourself. You have to convince yourself that this is worth doing for however many pages. And in the short story, that's true as well, but it's just really compressed into this very, very concise format, you know, and then letting it go and it goes out into the world and you have no control of what anybody thinks about it. You know, so I do think, you know, like there's a way in which because the short story is so compressed, you know, like it gives you a chance to try things that you might not try otherwise, you know, because a novel is such a big commitment. It's like, okay, I have this idea, you know, I'm going to like commit to working on it for ages. The short story, you can say, oh, I have an idea. I'm going to just try it out and let's see what happens, you know? And so there is like a lightness to it. And it can be fun and you can play and like, oh, it does. If it doesn't work, then you move on to something else tomorrow. Right. And I do love that about writing short stories. And I also love it about reading them. You know, you're testing things out, you're giving it a go. And then, you know, like you see what happens. But it sounds like a great assignment.
I may have to bring that back. Not this year, because I'm teaching for speculative fiction instead of any creative writing, but maybe for 2027. In the spirit of play, though, I am curious, for Church of Divine Electricity, is there a story in it that felt to you more like play than the others? And now that you're thinking back on crafting them?
Yeah, I mean, they all felt pretty playful. You know, so there's a story in the book which is called Forgotten Pastimes of the Victorians. And, you know, I'd love... stories that are episodic and modular, you know, stories where they don't necessarily even have a plot that goes all the way through them, but they have these different discrete episodes, you know, and you move from one to the other, you know, like almost like a series of paintings, right? Like your visual artists, if they have something they're working on, they get to do a bunch of versions of it. I've always loved stories that do that. Margaret Atwood has a story called My Life as a Bat, where she just like, it's, you know, it's like her narrator thinks about, I think I was a bat in a past life. And then she just ruminates on, you know, sort of what that experience would be like to have been a bat. And you know, that story is, you know, like is one that I come back to again and again. So the story in the collection, Forgotten Pastimes of the Victorians, you know, we know that in reality, 100, 150 years ago, people did incredibly strange things to keep themselves amused. You know, Victorians would do like really long walking races, you know, where they just, you know, people would go around and around a track, and they couldn't run and it would go on for hours and, so, you know, and sometimes days. And that was real. And so I wanted to create a list of things that were almost real, you know, and that the reader would almost believe people did for fun 150 years ago, but in fact weren't real. And so that story, you know, so once I came up with the first idea for that, which was endurance sneezing contests, you know, so in the story... you know, there was a sport called sternutationism, where people would sneeze as many times as possible in a row, and the person who sneezed the most times would win. And the story gives like a whole kind of history of like the sport and how it came to be and how once we had germ theory, then it had to go away, obviously, because you can't have people sneezing on each other in enclosed spaces. And so, you know, so once I'd come up with that idea, then I was like, oh, okay. Like now I'm off to the races, so to speak. And I came up with the other, you know, sort of seven, you know, Victorian, like lost pastimes, like very, very quickly, including, you know, bonnet fighting, you know, like I imagined a world in which women would like take off their bonnets and like go at each other, you know, and, you know, there's, you know, there's, you know, people collecting, like sections of the whiskers of famous men, like their beards and mustaches, you know, and then there's some that are more serious, you know, like I got into the idea of like, you know, the urchin hunt, like, you know, like gentlemen going through the streets of Victorian London and hunting for urchins, you know, and so the story kind of goes somewhere to like, you know, to like, you know, I hope, you know, the reader will be thinking about, you know, the fact that, you know, people do things for pastimes, you know, for fun that are, you know, that are cruel and that, you know, that we would find appalling now, you know, but, you know, maybe still, you know, there are things people do for fun that are in fact appalling. But the fun of creating, these imaginary pastimes was really like, it was a delight. Like, you know, like that was, you know, that was maybe the most fun story to write.
That's cool.
That is an amazing concept, and I love it. Well, that's the kind of high water mark that I like to move to Picks of the Week on. So, shall we?
We'll get to Picks of the Week in just a second. I wanted to take a moment to say it's been 3 years. 3 years since anyone has given us a star or a review on Apple Podcasts. And that's just insane. So, if you like what we do, please take a couple of minutes, go over to Apple Podcasts and give us a star and maybe some kind of kind words, like a review. And if you don't use Apple Podcasts, no worries. Take those same couple of minutes to give us a star and some kind words on your favorite podcast catcher or platform, whatever that may be. It really does help. Now, back to what you really wanted to hear, Picks of the Week.
All right. So, Patrick, what is the pick for this, the final episode of 2025?
Believe it or not, Emily has inspired me to do two.
Ooh.
So the first one is a game I've been playing on Steam called Everspace 2. I've never played Everspace 1. And what I wanted was a ships in space fighting, don't have to think about it, no-brainer kind of game. And I kind of had that in Galaxy Highways, but at the same time, there was two games that were on sale, Galaxy Highways and Everspace 2. So I bought both of them, and I've been playing Galaxy Highways quite a bit, but I decided, well, you know, I bought this other game, I should give it a shot. And it's the graphics are much, much better. Galaxy Highways is more 8-bit. Looking kind of classic arcade, and Everspace 2 is more modern, very slick, very sleek, except for the cutscenes, which are like stop motion comic book esque, which is kind of weird. But I'm enjoying it. It's interesting. It's got a good story. I will say, like, I'm just playing it on normal mode. I played through the tutorial and I was like, oh, I got this. This is fine. And then I got to like the very first mission and I flew and these raiders just showed up and blew me up. And I was like, it just got hard. Like, just like that, it got hard. So that's one. I'm playing that on Steam. The other one is the Glass Cannons Campaign 3. This is an actual play podcast, and they have switched to Shadow Dark. And I did not know if I would like Shadow Dark or not as a actual play. But I am really enjoying listening to them play this game. They used random tables to roll their characters. The GM's using random tables to create encounters for them. It's really, really interesting, really, really creative in how they're doing this. And telling a story, like I'm so used to other games like 5e and Pathfinder and kind of how those games are crafted that having this old school game system, I just didn't think I would like it, but I'm liking it. I'm liking it a lot. So that's Glass Cannon Campaign 3 Shadow Dark.
Fantastic. Fantastic. So Emily, how about you?
Okay, so my picks of the week, I am gonna have two. The first one is a novel. You know, it's older, but I came across it really recently, I loved it so much. You know, I'm sure plenty of your readers are familiar with this, but I feel like, you know, this writer in this book, like, couldn't have enough readers. I just think everybody should know about it. So it's Tyneron by Lena Crone, who's Finnish, a collection of her fiction was translated and published in English in 2015 by Cheeky Frog Books, which is a project of Jeff and Anne Vandermeer. And I just came across this, pretty recently. And it's this beautiful book in which the narrator is on a journey to a city of insects. All of the characters, the residents of this city are insects. And it's a series of letters that the narrator is writing home to the place that they come from, which we never really find out about the wonders of this strange city. When I read this, I was like, where have you been all my life? Like, I couldn't believe how great this was. That is one of my picks of the week. And then a more recent current thing. I saw the show Death by Lightning a couple of weeks ago, which tells the story of James Garfield's very short presidency and the guy who assassinated him, Charles Guiteau. And it's based on, it's based on a work of nonfiction, so all of the stuff that is in it, are things that really happened. But it's just so brilliantly portrayed, just spot on, about political political convictions and people getting caught up in, the things that they have just come to believe recently and the kind of hysteria that can come with that and what it can drive people to. And it's also extremely funny. It's not a part of history that it's super easy to be funny about, it manages both of those things. So that's my second pick of the week, Death by Lightning.
I believe, Ron Swanson's in that. Nick.
Yes. Nick Offerman.
Yeah.
Nick
Offerman. Yeah. Yeah. It's Chester Arthur, and he's great.
Netflix keeps spitting that up to me, saying I should watch that. So now I've got more of an incentive to watch it.
I should have to see if Corwin wants to watch that, since he's going to be a major in history and education. So he's very interested in American history. So yeah, just to see if I can get the boy to settle down with me on that.
The other one that's more serious that he might be interested in is Turn, which is about the Revolutionary War and people joining the Revolutionary War.
Good to know.
And I think that's part of George Washington's spy network being created. Mm. Which is great history. I mean, if you're into like cool things,
yeah. Just cool stuff.
Just finding out that George Washington had a spy network that continued past like him in being president and stuff, that started in the Revolutionary War and continued on. That's just cool stuff.
All right. So with all of that, like we've got some watch recommendations. And if you're anything, if your household around the holidays is anything like my household around the holidays, there's a lot of snacks that happen. So this is actually a recipe recommendation. And this is a simple enough recipe recommendation for something that is on constant rotation during the holidays in Shea Townsend that I can just dictate the recipe over to you and you don't even need to worry about writing nothing down. The recipe comes by way of my maternal grandmother. It's an adaptation of it that I've done. And it involves three ingredients. You got oyster crackers, you got some kind of cooking oil, and you've got the ranch seasoning powder of your choice. You like the spicy, do the spicy. You like the regular, do the regular. You like some other manifestation, you do you, boo. My particular local market does a house brand jalapeno version of the ranch seasoning, so that's our go-to. What you do is you get yourselves your standard issue bag of oyster crackers. Yes, generic works fine. You can get them for like $1.80 from most local markets. It's so cheap. And for every bag of oyster crackers, you're going to mix it with one packet of that dressing mix that you have combined with 1/4 cup of the oil. You make that sludge, you toss that stuff in it, you put it in a slow oven about like 250 degrees, 300 if you're kind of impatient, for anywhere from 20 minutes to a half an hour. Every now and again, you pull it out and toss it around a little bit, make sure it gets toasted up and dry. And once it's toasted up and dry in a way that you like, let it cool if it lives that long. Or just eat it directly hot out of the pan like a bunch of feral animals, which is what we do here. So enough of that has been consumed that I am going to have to go to the store after this recording is done to get more of the ingredients, because the beasts desire to be pleased. And what am I here for but to give them what they want at the holidays? So ranch crackers, 3 ingredients. I won't say you won't regret it, because actually you so will. It's just all carbs, and salt and stuff, but you actually kind of won't regret it either. So I don't know, eat it while you're watching stuff about dead presidents and spy networks. It'd be cool.
To bring it full circle, Chef Townsend, yes. You have been chopped.
Ah, damn it. That probably means that we're nearing the end of the episode, which leaves us with the only creator left standing, Emily Mitchell. Emily, where can people find you and your super cool stuff?
I'm on Instagram as ELB Mitchell. You can also find out more about me and my books at my website, which is emilymitchellwriter.com.
Fantastic. Well, happy new year to you and yours.
Thank you. And to you as well. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
We had a great time.
Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of The Functional Nerds. We really appreciate it. If you liked this episode, or really any of our episodes, please consider backing us over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. You can get access to some cool stuff and help us to keep the lights on. You can also show your support by mentioning us and sharing any of our episodes on your own social channels to help boost the signal. Trust me, that can be huge.
Mr. Carpiers.
You got it right. How about that?
Yeah.
You can call me Cannoli Joe.
Hello, Cannoli Joe.
If you've never listened to the podcast, there's two different styles here. There's Tracy, who does prep work and comes up with some very thoughtful questions. And then, oh, squirrel.
Oh, for God's sake, Patrick Louise.
Hello, Patrick. It is I, Clayface.
Okay. That's probably a good enough signal.
When someone comes up to me and says, hey, I really love what you do, I'm like, I'm sorry, do you know who I, like, I think you have me confused with someone else.
The whiz bang and the gosh wow and the sense of wonder stuff.
My favorite thing about time travel is I actually had a time travel joke for you guys, but you didn't like it.
I'm so excited.